Okay, imagine watching the market open last Friday, August 29th, 2025, and the Nasdaq just drops like a stone. What on earth was going on?
Yeah, it was a real head scratcher for a lot of people.
Definitely. A moment of, genuine disbelief. Your first thought is, okay, is this just typical month-end stuff?
Right. We usually see some action.
Exactly. You expect things like portfolio rebalancing, maybe a bit of what they call window dressing, or funds sorting out their cash
But not
positions.
usually that kind of sharp, immediate plunge. That felt different.
It really did. So today on the Deep Dive, we want to cut through that noise. We're going to try and understand what's really driving these big market swings.
Differentiating the, let's say, normal mechanics from something else entirely. Maybe something more questionable, or maybe just an external shock.
Precisely. We'll tackle both sides. The usual month-end things that often influence prices, and then, well, figure out what actually sent the market tumbling last Friday.
Sounds good.
So you might think month-end trading is just, business as usual, but there are some really fascinating forces regularly at play. They aren't just random wiggles on a chart.
That's absolutely right. These are often driven by very deliberate strategies from the big institutional players.
Like what? What are the main ones?
Well, one of the biggest is portfolio rebalancing. Think about large funds. Many have strict rules, mandates about how their money is split.
Like the classic 60-40 stocks and bonds idea.
Exactly, or maybe limits on how much they can hold in tech or energy or whatever sector. Over the month, naturally, prices move. Some stocks do great, some lag.
So the percentages get out of whack.
Precisely. The weightings get skewed. So typically on the last trading day, fund managers have to step in. They'll sell winners, the ones that outperform.
And by the ones that lag behind.
Right, to get the portfolio back into that required balance.
Okay.
And this isn't trivial. It creates really significant flows of money moving between different assets, different indices, different sectors. That alone can move prices.
Especially if everyone's doing it at the same time.
Absolutely. Plus, think about how many funds are benchmarked against something like the S&P 500. They have to adjust their holdings at month end to keep tracking the index properly, especially if the index itself changes slightly.
Ah, okay. So that concentration of activity really ramps up the trading volume.
It does. Volume and volatility often spike right at month end because of this rebalancing.
I see. So it's like keeping the portfolio aligned with the rules, a sort of financial tune-up. Makes sense. But what about just, well, cash? Funds have money coming in and going out, right?
Exactly. That's the second piece, cash positioning. Institutions like pension funds often have very predictable cash flows timed around month end.
Like contributions coming in, or maybe needing cash to pay out benefits.
Both. Regular pension contributions might arrive, or they might need to pay out withdrawals. So, to handle this, they might need to sell assets to raise cash or deploy excess cash that's just arrived.
And they often do this right near the end of the month.
Often, yes. It can lead to pretty significant buying or selling pressure just from managing their basic liquidity needs.
Okay, that covers the sort of mechanical adjustments. But now, this is where it gets really interesting, I think, because not everything is purely about balancing the books or managing cash flow. Sometimes it's about appearances.
Yes, there's definitely an artful side to it. This is where we get into window dressing.
Window dressing sounds like something you do before guests arrive.
Huh, it's actually not far off.
Oh.
Money managers, quite understandably, want their portfolios to look good, especially in those end-of-month or end-of-quarter reports they send to clients.
They want to look smart.
Pretty much. The goal is to tweak the holdings list right before the snapshot is taken to present a more favorable picture.
How does that work in practice?
Well, typically, they might buy stocks that have been performing really strongly right before the report date.
So they can say, look, we own the winners.
Exactly. It makes it look like they were holding on to those high flyers all along. And conversely, they might sell off the poor performers, or maybe stocks involved in some controversy.
So those names just don't appear on the list the client sees.
Right. Let's take a concrete example. Imagine a fund's quarterly report is due. NVIDIA has been soaring, but maybe AT&T has been slumping.
Okay.
The manager might buy some NVIDIA shares just before the reporting date, so NVIDIA shows up nicely in their top 10 holdings. At the same time, they might quietly sell their AT&T position.
So the client sees the NVIDIA, doesn't see the AT&T. Looks
That's
good.
good, good. But here's the key. These last-minute trades usually happen too late to have materially impacted the fund's actual performance over the past month or quarter. It just changes the appearance of what they owned at that specific moment in time.
So it's optics, purely cosmetic.
Largely, yes. but it can create real market effects. If lots of managers are trying to buy the same hot stocks for window dressing purposes, that can create artificial buying pressure.
Right. It's like everyone trying to get the same must-have item before a party. But okay, appearance is one thing. What about actual results? Managers need to deliver good monthly performance numbers too, don't they?
They absolutely do. And that brings us to another related practice, performance marking.
Okay, how's that different from window dressing?
The motivation here is more direct. It's about the actual reported performance figure for the month. Managers want that number to look solid. Their compensation might even be tied to it.
So they're trying to lock in gains or maybe just smooth things out.
Exactly. Tactics can vary. A manager might sell some of their winners towards the end of the month just to make sure a sudden last day market drop doesn't wipe out their profits.
Crystallize the gains.
Right. Or they might reduce risk overall. Sell off some of the more volatile stocks in the portfolio so it's less likely to swing wildly right at the last minute before the performance snapshot is taken. It helps solidify that monthly number.
Okay, so we've got rebalancing, cash needs, making things look good with window dressing, and locking in results with performance marking. Seems like a lot going on.
It is, but sometimes that drive to boost results can cross a line. It can move from strategic management into something much more questionable, something regulators watch very closely.
Right. This is where things can get murky.
That's a good way to put it. We're talking about marking the book, or sometimes it's called marking the close.
Marking the close. Okay, what does that involve?
This is a very specific thing. It involves trading a security deliberately right before the valuation point, like the market close on the last day of the month, with the intention of influencing the price that's used to value the entire portfolio's holding of that stock.
So it's not just managing risk, it's trying to actively push the price up.
Or sometimes down, though, usually up.
Yeah.
It's about artificially impacting the reported value of the fund. This really highlights that fine line, sometimes a blurry line, between legitimate trading and, frankly, market manipulation.
Can you give an example of how that would work?
Sure. And this comes from regulatory cases and sources we looked at. Imagine a fund owns, say, 500,000 shares of a small cap stock that doesn't trade very often. Let's say the last trade was at $10 a share.
Okay. Thinly traded.
Right. Now, minutes before the market closes on the last day of the month, the fund manager, or maybe a broker working with them, places an order to buy just 1,000 shares. A tiny amount compared to their holding.
Only 1,000 shares.
Yeah, but they place the buy order at $10.50. Because it's thinly traded, this small buy order might actually become the last trade of the day, setting the official closing price.
Ah, so the closing price is now $10.50, not $10.
Exactly. And because that's the official closing price, the fund gets to value its entire 500,000 share position at $10.50.
Wow. So that little trade just added 50 cents times 500,000 shares, $250,000 to the reported value.
Precisely. $250,000 in paper gain just from one tiny strategically priced trade.
That seems definitely problematic. Is it illegal?
If it's done with the intent to manipulate the price, yes, it's considered market manipulation and it is illegal. The challenge, though, is proving intent.
How do you tell it apart from a legitimate last-minute rebalancing trade?
That's the tricky part. It can be very difficult to distinguish sometimes. That's why regulators use surveillance systems to look for patterns. Are the trades always tiny relative to the position? Do they always happen right at the close on month end or quarter end? Does the price often snap back down the next trading day?
So they look for suspicious patterns.
Yes. And they do bring cases, they monitor this actively, and fund managers have been fined for it. It's a serious reminder that not all reported performance is necessarily earned through skillful investing.
And this isn't just theoretical, right? You mentioned cases. Regulators actually catch people doing this.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just a what if. The SEC, for example, has pursued these cases. There was one back in 2013 where they fined a hedge fund manager for marking the close in several microcap stocks.
What tipped them off?
The patterns were pretty clear. The manager was consistently making these tiny buy orders at inflated prices, right in the last minutes of trading, particularly at quarter ends. It boosted his portfolio values by millions on paper.
And the price dropped back afterwards.
Often, yes. That was one of the red flags. Tiny trades, always at the end of reporting periods, inflated prices that didn't stick. It all pointed towards manipulation.
Any more recent examples?
Yes, actually. In January 2023, the SEC filed a lawsuit against another private hedge fund manager. The accusation was similar, inflating the fund's value by manipulating the closing price of its biggest holding, which was another thinly traded stock.
How did they allegedly do it that time?
In that case, the manager was accused of funneling money to a friend, who then used it to place small buy orders near the close, again, particularly on month-end days. And these buy orders were placed at prices above the prevailing market quotes.
So deliberately overpaying to push the close higher.
That was the allegation. And according to the SEC, these orders artificially boosted the stock's closing price by anywhere from 13% to nearly 99% on different month ends.
Wow, 99%? That's incredible.
Incredible. And the alleged result was, of course, a massively inflated net asset value for the fund. This meant better reported performance, which attracted more investors, and presumably higher fees for the manager.
Goodness. It really does sound like something straight out of a movie script.
It kind of does.
Yeah.
Pop culture loves market manipulation stories, even if they aren't exactly marking the close. Think about the Wolf of Wall Street.
Right, the pump and dump schemes.
Exactly. Running up stock prices with coordinated buying and then dumping them. Different mechanism, but still manipulating prices for gain. Or think way back to Trading Places.
Yeah. Frozen concentrated orange juice.
Like cornering the market. Again, market manipulation, just a different flavor.
Yeah.
So yeah, Hollywood gets the drama, even if the specifics vary.
It definitely highlights how these schemes capture the imagination. Okay, so we have all these dynamics. The normal rebalancing, the cosmetic window dressing, even these shady marking the book tactics. With all that going on, you'd think month ends might have some predictable patterns. And historically, don't they?
They often do. There's a well-documented phenomenon called the turn-of-the-month effect.
Okay, what's that?
Historically, looking back over long periods, the S&P 500 actually shows a noticeable positive bias on the last trading day of the month.
Really? It tends to go up more often than not?
Yes. Sources suggest that somewhere between 60% and 65% of the time, the market closes higher on the last day of the month compared to the day before.
And how does that compare to just any random day?
Well, the overall baseline up-day frequency for the S&P 500 is usually around 53% to 55%. So that 60-65% at month-end is significantly higher.
Interesting. So statistically, month-ends tend to be positive.
They do. It suggests that all those activities we discussed, rebalancing, cash deployment, maybe even window dressing buying collectively, tend to push prices up more often than down on that final day.
But this past Friday, August 29th, 2025, yeah. That pattern was just completely shattered, wasn't it?
Utterly broken.
That positive bias, gone.
Yeah.
Instead, we got that big drop we started with. So what does all this mean? Clearly, something else overwhelmed the usual month-end effects. What was the real culprit?
You're exactly right. All those typical month-end factors were likely still happening under the surface, but they were completely swamped by a major external event. The real reason for Friday's sharp drop wasn't market mechanics at all. It was a... let's call it a tariff tantrum.
A tariff tantrum. Okay, triggered by what?
It was triggered by a significant court announcement that day. Specifically, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit issued a major decision.
What did they rule?
It was a 7-4 decision, and they ruled that the Trump-era tariffs were, in fact, illegal. They stated the tariffs exceeded presidential authority under a law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a big deal. Hasn't this been argued before?
Oh, yes. This isn't the first ruling on the matter. There's been back and forth through various courts already. The Court of International Trade, the Appeals Court, the Federal Circuit. It's an ongoing legal battle.
So this ruling came out Friday morning, and the market reacted immediately.
Pretty much. But there's a crucial twist. While the court ruled the tariffs illegal, they also delayed the implementation of that ruling.
Delayed it. Until when?
Until October 14th. They explicitly did this to give the current administration time to appeal the decision to the Supreme Court.
Ah, so it creates this period of limbo uncertainty.
Exactly. Massive uncertainty. And that's what really spooked the market. So it wasn't necessarily the ruling itself, but the prolonged uncertainty it creates about U.S. trade policy, import costs, supply chains, corporate earnings, everything.
Investors hate uncertainty more than almost anything.
Precisely. This kind of policy instability makes it incredibly hard for businesses to plan, to forecast, to make investment decisions. So you saw a broad sell-off hitting sectors that are sensitive to trade and tariffs particularly hard. It just completely overwhelmed any typical month-end positive vibes.
So it wasn't the portfolio managers or the accounting tricks this time. It was a major legal curveball throwing a wrench into economic policy expectations.
That's the story of last Friday. And what's really fascinating, I think, is seeing how these ongoing legal battles, some people are calling it lawfare, you know, using the legal system for strategic goals, how they inject this huge element of unpredictability into the markets.
Even when the underlying economy might seem okay otherwise.
Right. Now, obviously, we're not here to take sides on the tariffs themselves, whether they're good or bad policy. Our focus is just on conveying the reported facts and showing how this judicial back and forth directly impacts market stability and investor sentiment. It keeps everyone on edge, reacting to legal headlines as much as economic data.
Okay, let's try and wrap this up then. We've gone from the routine month-end stuff like portfolio rebalancing and cash positioning.
The necessary mechanics.
Right. Then we got into the more strategic appearance-driven side with window dressing.
Making things look good for the reports.
And then into the really problematic area, the legally murky waters of marking the book.
Where strategy crosses into potential manipulation.
We saw how all those internal factors can influence markets and even create historical patterns like the turn of the month effect.
But then
you get these external shocks, like this unexpected court ruling on tariffs last Friday, something that just comes out of left field and completely rewrites the script for the market, throwing all the usual patterns out the window.
Exactly. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, it just hammers home how diverse and complex the forces shaping our markets really are. It's this constant mix of human behavior, institutional strategy, regulatory pressures, and these completely unforeseen external events.
So it's rarely just one thing driving the market.
Almost never. And looking beyond the obvious headlines is crucial, which I think leads to a really important question for you, the listener, to consider. How do you think these ongoing legal battles over policy and the market uncertainty they create might influence investor behavior going forward, and maybe even future policy decisions? Especially with this built-in delay, this suspense, waiting to see if it goes to the Supreme Court. What does that do to market psychology?
That's a really powerful thought to chew on as you navigate the twists and turns out there. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive today.